The Triathlon Show 295. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. Ed Maunder and Dr. Stephen Seiler. Ed and Stephen join us to discuss the concept of durability, which they've discussed and investigated in a recent research paper from this year, from 2021. Durability essentially means how little or how much your physical performance deteriorates over the course of prolonged endurance exercise. Also, when does that happen? Does it happen after 2 hours or after 5 hours? We will discuss the ins and outs of durability from both a theoretical, scientific standpoint, but importantly, we'll get into plenty of practical tips and takeaways, like how do you actually train to improve durability, which I think is a really important message from this episode. I just want to give you a heads up that for a large part of the interview, it's just Dr. Ed Maunder and myself, and then Dr. Stephen Seiler joins pretty late in the interview, but he will come in towards the latter part of the interview. But before we get into it, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Roka produce exceptional quality wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, performance sunglasses, as well as prescription eyeglasses and sunglasses. In their eyewear category, they have plenty of really cool features, such as the Geico anti-slip technology, but also in the purchasing process, they have an online vision test for prescription updates, and they have home try-on options available for eyeglasses. Roka ship from the US, the UK, and EU, and they are trusted by world-leading athletes such as Lucy Charles Barclay, Javier Gomez, Flora Duffy, Morgan Pearson, Summer Rappaport, and many others in triathlon, as well as cycling, speed skating, and many, many more. Visit roka.com/TTS for 20% off your order. And thank you to Sen8. The Sen8 Indoor Swim Trainer is a tool for time-crunched triathletes looking to improve their swim-specific strength and technique. The Sen8 Swim Trainer is trusted by the BMC Pro Triathlon team, by age group triathletes, coaches, and physios around the world. And until mid-August, you can get more than 40% off the Sen8 Swim Trainer when you combine the ongoing summer sale with the special 20% discount that you can get on sen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. On that page, you'll get a discount code that you will then add at checkout, taking that total discount to more than 40% off. So now is a really, really good time to shop for the Sen8 Swim Trainer. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Dr. Ed Maunder and Dr. Stephen Seiler. I'm here with Ed Maunder. Ed, welcome to That Triathlon Show. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
It's a pleasure. Can you start by just giving an introduction to yourself for the listeners? Tell us what you're doing, where you're located, and a little bit of your sporting background.
Yeah, sure. So I'm now a lecturer at AUT, which is Auckland University of Technology in New Zealand. I'm originally from the UK, studied at the University of Bath and the University of Birmingham. And then I moved across from the UK to New Zealand to do a PhD, which I've now finished, and working at AUT since then. My research relates to endurance sport for health and for performance as well.
And the one thing that you have been researching recently that is the main topic for this interview is the concept of durability. Can you explain what you mean by durability and why it is important for endurance sports, at least in many endurance sports it is?
Sure, yeah. So I think briefly I would define durability as sort of an athlete's resilience to deteriorations in their exercising physiology over time during very long duration exercise. So in terms of why that's important and worth thinking about, so as well as being a researcher and work in applied exercise physiology too, so do a lot of work with endurance athletes. And one of the main roles that we have is profiling an athlete's physiology. So getting someone into the lab and providing them with information about their exercising physiology to provide training zones, that sort of thing. And we'll typically do that with an athlete that comes in well rested, and we'll give them threshold powers and heart rates and that sort of thing. So those numbers are potentially useful to apply for training, but of course many endurance athletes are doing very, very long duration training sessions. So whether those numbers actually are still useful in the third, fourth, fifth hour of training is a question that really we're sort of only just beginning to unpack.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you mentioned there with the third, fourth, or fifth hour. And I think in your paper, which we'll link to, of course, in the show notes, it's called The Importance of Durability in the Physiological Profiling of Endurance Athletes. You mentioned that as another aspect of the definition of durability, I guess, is when the deterioration starts to happen, not just the time point and the magnitude of it, if you will, the combination of those two. When you profile these athletes, how much do you find, and this can be a very qualitative answer, we can get into quantitative, how to quantify it a bit later, but do you find that this differs very much from athletes even within the same sport and discipline, or is it something that at the top level a lot of athletes are kind of similar? What's your sort of just qualitative take on that?
Yeah, so my take on that would be that there is quite a bit of variation between athletes, even at similar within similar sports. So you take a long distance triathlete, for instance, there might be some who are very resilient to changes over time, and they have very stable physiology across long bouts of exercise, and there might be others who are more susceptible to, for instance, increases in heart rate at a constant power over a long period of training. So that's one of the reasons why I think it's quite an important concept for us as researchers to be concerned with, is I do think that it's a trait that is different between athletes.
Yeah. It's one of the implications of this concept of durability is, of course, raising performance. It makes total sense that if you are more resilient to changes to deterioration in your physiology, then you're more likely to be successful in long distance endurance events. You mentioned there the training aspect as well. And can you maybe go a bit deeper into more detail on how might you, if you're an athlete or a coach even, take the durability and the resilience of the athlete into account when planning training, and how might it benefit you to know the durability profile of an athlete when planning their training?
Yeah, so there's sort of a few different aspects of that I think are worth considering. So the first might be, as an exercise physiologist, if you're profiling an athlete, you might give someone a lactate threshold, power or pace, and an associated heart rate value, and then you might the coach may use those numbers to plan training sessions in order to keep an athlete within a given intensity domain during training sessions. So you might go out for your long ride at the weekend or something and decide that you're going to keep your power below 200 watts, for instance, or a heart rate of 140 or something. Now, one thing that I'm sort of is quite surprising that we don't really know the answer to from the research yet is whether those heart rate values are stable with very, very prolonged exercise. So we can suspect that the work that you'll produce at those thresholds will decrease to a greater or lesser extent and with prolonged exercise. But we don't really have a good answer for whether that cardiovascular drift we see during long duration exercise matches the drift in our exercising physiology. So that's something that I think we need to, an assumption that we make, that's research that needs to be done.
Sorry, can you clarify that? So the assumption is that, how would you assume that the cardiovascular drift might or might not relate to the underlying physiology there, and where does the training prescription and how you do the training prescription come into that? I wasn't quite following.
Okay, sorry. So the if we identified an athlete's lactate threshold, for instance, occurred at heart rate of 140 beats per minute. An assumption we might make is that in order to maintain a low physiological stress response over a long duration training session, a strategy to do that might be to maintain our heart rate below 140 for the duration of that session and let whatever happens to the power and pace happen. Sort of a heart rate controlled approach. Now, if we were to
we're talking about the first lactate threshold in this example.
In this example,
rather than the second.
Yeah. So, and we can be relatively confident that when we early on in an exercise bout, when we cross that heart rate value, we're going to drift physiologically above that first lactate threshold. Now, whether that heart rate value is the correct value to be using in the third, fourth, or fifth hour of a training session is something that we don't know. So it's an assumption that we make, and the research still needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, you'll know this much better than I do. I did actually, funnily enough, just a coincidence, not related to our interview, read some papers about cardiovascular drift just last week. And there were some interesting papers, and a summary, I think, by Ed Coyle was particularly interesting, where he kind of argued that a lot of cardiovascular drift is just explained by hydration status, hyperthermia status, and even glycemic blood glucose status. So that was an interesting take by him, that if you control those factors, then you see a kind of quite a small cardiovascular drift, if any. But I'm sure that you've looked into this much closer than I do. So your point there is that it's not really clear. We need more research to really figure out what's going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. And those factors that you mentioned may acutely impact an individual's durability, as we termed it.
Yeah. So maybe let's go into that. So what are the potential mechanisms behind why one person may be a lot more durable than another, and the moderating factors as well, like hyperthermia, environmental conditions, and hydration status, and so on.
Yeah. So in terms of the underlying physiology, I think it's probably fair to say that again, we don't really know the answer. I suspect that fiber type profile might have something to do with it. So athletes who are more slow twitch or more type 1 fiber in their makeup are probably more prone to be more durable. That would be my best guess. There may be something related to our oxidative machinery. So having more mitochondrial protein within our muscle may be useful for durability, but again, not sure. Not sure that, again, that research needs to be done. From a training perspective, and this is just in my experience, I think it does seem that you need to do very long duration training in your training program in order to develop those durability characteristics. If you're never going beyond an hour or two in your training sessions, it's unlikely that you're going to respond well in that third, fourth, or fifth hour of exercise compared to someone who does do that regularly.
That makes perfect sense. And what about moderating factors? So we mentioned a couple there already. The environmental conditions like heat could have an impact, and hydration status. Are there any other that you can think of? Which within an individual from 1 week to the next, for example, could impact their durability.
So maintaining carbohydrate availability could well have a moderating influence there. I think there has been a small amount of research done in that space. So if you're better able to maintain carbohydrate availability to fuel your exercise, it's likely that those durability characteristics will be improved. So I think that's something that athletes can pay attention to for sure.
Yeah. The paper that you wrote, it's a review-like paper, I would say. You do have some data there that is collected through online, through Twitter, essentially. So just field examples. But you do summarize a lot of the the data that exists previously that that can kind of be classified as within this durability concept. So can you go into a little bit how much data or literature exists around this, and what about the field data or anecdotal data that you've seen? Like how much do we really know about it, and how much don't we know about it? How little or how much exists?
Yeah. So I think short answer would be that there isn't a huge amount of data on this point, which I think is a problem, and that's something that in my research I'm trying to address. The physiology of long duration exercises has seen a lot of research. So there are some inferences that we can make from that that data. So for instance, there's some good evidence that your running economy or your gross cycling efficiency, so how efficient, how economical you are in your movement, that will decrease over time. And I think that has very strong implications in durability. Because if you imagine that you're becoming less economical as exercise progresses, and that just means that a given energy expenditure metabolically will produce less speed or will produce less watts on the bike. So there are some assumptions that we can make from that data, which is quite compelling. Some of the other data that we discussed in the paper, so there was a good series of studies that was done in the UK at the University of Exeter, and they looked at critical power and how that changed following a couple of hours of quite decent intensity exercise, and through a range of different models, they showed that your critical power during a cycling 3-minute all-out test decreased as a result of a couple of hours of exercise, and there was some moderating influence of carbohydrate intake in that series of studies. So that was some quite interesting data that was there. I think one of the key bits of information that we had in the field data that was collected and then presented in this paper was from a relatively large group of cyclists training indoors, probably during COVID lockdowns and things. And they cycled at a constant work rate for 4 hours. So quite a moderate sort of intensity ride that lasted a full 4 hours. And they measured their heart rate and how that changed over the course of that 4 hours. And you could see that there was quite a lot of variability in the degree to which heart rate uncoupled from power across that 4 hours. So some people maintained a relatively steady heart rate across the full 4 hours. And whereas there were other individuals who saw quite large increases in heart rate towards the end of that 4 hour constant load ride. So I think that's quite compelling information in that this is a trait worth considering in coaching and in sport because it's something that's going to differentiate different athletes.
Yeah. In that 4 hour, the group that did a 4 hour ride indoors, you had a really interesting way of quantifying the durability or the change in or how the physiology kind of progressed through that ride with the measuring the or calculating the internal to external workload ratio by using percentage of heart rate reserve divided by the percentage of 6 minutes maximal power that the cyclist could produce, and then you could really see these three groups, one with a really kind of low decoupling between the internal and the external load, and then one group with a moderate and one group with a high decoupling, and those characteristics are really drastically different in those three groups. But I think that it was just a really smart way of quantifying it using heart rate reserve is I guess maybe the best way we have of kind of use as a proxy for actual oxygen consumption, and then the percentage of 6 minutes maximal power is obviously a very, very safe way of quantifying the external load. Power is a very, very good stable metric for that. So that was just something for that I wanted to mention for the listeners to consider as well. This is something that they can maybe self experiment with during a long session. It's not that difficult really to create your own field test, if you will, and see see how you do, where you stack up right now, and then see how you progress if you do some specific training interventions as well to address your durability.
Yeah, for sure. And I've got to give credit to Stephen Seiler, who was one of the authors on the paper, and that was certainly his means of quantifying those changes in internal to external workload across that 4 hours. And I agree, it's a very I think that is quite a useful way of certainly quantifying field data. So I would encourage cyclists in the field to use a could potentially use a similar approach to monitor that durability characteristics.
Yeah, and I think there again, it's worth pointing out that you did also ask these cyclists to provide their body weight before and after and fluid consumption so that you could control for that as well. So that's something if a listener wants to do this field test themselves, I would say that that's something that you should definitely do to make sure that if you have a large heart rate increase, that it's not because you're completely dehydrated, but actually you kind of control the level of dehydration that you experience and make sure that it's not at least a majority of the heart rate decoupling is not related to just being really severely dehydrated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and other than this particular means of quantifying and assessing durability, also you mentioned the critical power decrement after a prolonged endurance exercise. Have you seen and used any other means of assessing or quantifying durability in the literature or when you've been working with your own field data?
Yeah, so in terms of validated assessments from the literature, I don't think there are a sort of strong availability there. But I do think particularly for athletes who do perform very long duration exercise, so your long distance triathletes would be a good example. I think performing any kind of athlete testing, but following a prolonged period of exercise, so rather than doing an assessment when fresh, whether that's a 20-minute power test or a laboratory based assessment, and rather than doing that fresh, doing that after two or three hours of training, that might be a good means of appreciating these durability characteristics for sure. So looking at the drop off in whatever metric it is that you're testing yourself with when it's done after a multiple hour bout of exercise.
Yeah, in the critical power data that you mentioned, what was the cohort there? Were those recreational athletes or elite athletes? What I'm getting at here is there a benchmark in elite athletes of how good your durability can get, or is that something that we're lacking currently?
From memory, they weren't elite athletes. And no, I don't think there are strong benchmarks there available, some sort of normative values like you might have for VO2 max or something. No, there's certainly not that data available yet.
Yeah, all right. But even so, I think the point there is a good one. Athletes can self-assess after doing prolonged exercise and just see how if they're developing in that regard. And I think we all kind of intuitively know if we still have room to improve in that third, fourth, or fifth hour, and if that's something that can be developed. And to be honest, I think that, as you say, for most amateur athletes anyway, it is something that can be improved because we just don't have the ability to train as much and do as many of those long sessions as elite athletes do. So if even elite athletes, probably a lot of them can still improve it, but then that would mean that almost all amateur athletes probably have some room for improvement. It doesn't necessarily mean always like that you have to do 5 hour training sessions every week or so, but I guess being smart about training, and maybe we can get into that, other than increasing the amount of long duration training you do. Do you have any other suggestions for how to go about improving durability?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and one that I would certainly like to know the answer to. There are lots of different strategies for manipulating exercise training variables, I suppose, that have been studied. And certainly, I don't think, that, again, there is data in the literature to tell us the answer there. Other than going very long, I would be scratching my head to know what a good recommendation would be. I think the way that we respond to exercise, we need to put ourselves physiologically in the situation. So that's the sort of specificity of training adaptation. So if there's some means by which we can make shorter duration exercise have similar traits to longer duration exercise, then that might be worth exploring, whether that might include, for instance, including some higher intensity efforts to deplete your energy stores and things earlier on in a training session to make the subsequent hour more long duration exercise like, if you like. That might be one way of doing it. But again, this is certainly just speculation at the moment.
Yeah. I find anecdotally that just the overall training volume plays a huge role here. And this is without even formally assessing durability, but just kind of the eyeballing test, I guess, of athletes' performance and durability and how it relates to their training volume. I think that maybe if you train at a higher volume, you're always a little bit more fatigued starting a session, and that kind of simulates what you go through even when you do a single long duration workout. So you might get to that sort of point of experiencing what you might experience in the fifth hour of a bike ride slightly earlier if you have the previous day done 3 hours of training of some form, which might be kind of moderate or hard intensity in at least parts of it. So I think that training volume overall, even if you can't do those really long sessions, can maybe have a positive impact on developing durability from a coaching perspective.
For sure. And just on that, I wonder if the sequencing of your exercise, your training throughout the week as well, might be a way to do that. So if that means, rather than if you've got an amateur athlete who traditionally trains each evening, there might be some opportunity to train an evening and then the following early morning. And that might be one means by which generating that long duration exercise response without it actually being individual long training sessions.
Yeah, definitely. And another concept that you mentioned in the paper is around high intensity repeatability. Can you explain that, define that, and how does that relate to durability?
Yeah, so conceptually, I think quite similar to durability, and that means that, but in a high intensity exercise context. So you could have two athletes, for instance, who have similar capacities over shorter distances. So whether that's 5-10 minute type efforts, but you may have one athlete who's more able to back that up, recover, and come back and do it again than another athlete. So that's what high intensity repeatability is about. An athlete's capacity to repeatedly perform bouts of higher intensity exercise performance.
Yep. And how you quantified that with some field data as well. Do you want to explain how you did that?
Yep. So there was some data included in that paper from a high level mountain bike rider. And we sort of just quantified their power data from a world championship event, I think it was. And you can just see the amount of work that they were able to perform above that threshold or critical power. So this is that exercise intensity domain that is inherently short-lived, so where you cannot maintain steady-state physiology. So that athlete was able to accumulate a huge amount of work above critical power across the event. And that's like or must mean that they were able to recover very effectively during the intervening short periods of much lower intensity work. So that's likely in certain events going to be a defining feature of what makes one athlete very successful and another less so.
Yeah. Yeah, you wrote in the paper that they obviously the athlete's critical power and W prime, their anaerobic battery. For listeners that might not know about W prime, it's kind of the energy that you have to spend above critical power. So the critical power was 380 watts and W prime was around 40 kilojoules. But then you calculated that over the course of this 90-minute race, he actually expended, 280 kilojoules of work above critical power compared to that 40 kilojoule, which was his W prime, which obviously relates to how much he could expend basically continuously going above critical power. But with the recovery that he got below critical power, he was able to make it... sevenfold the actual size of his W prime over the course of 90 minutes. So that's where, I guess, as a listener, maybe it's something worth looking into if you're racing that kind of racing, especially like mountain biking, where this is an important factor. How much can you expend over the course of a certain duration, and how does that relate to the size of your W prime?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. No, from doing interval training, that's a trait that you can see change over the course of a good block of training, is that your the power that you're doing in individual reps may not necessarily be that different early on. It's just your ability to repeat that and maintain those higher power outputs in the sixth, seventh, eighth repetition that you're doing may be improved. And that's something that you tend to see with athletes quite a bit.
Yeah. And do you think that this high intensity repeatability, is it more related to aerobic development or anaerobic development?
That's a good question. Probably both. So fitter athletes, athletes with a greater aerobic capacity, aerobic capabilities, likely able to recover faster from high intensity bouts of exercise. So developing your aerobic capabilities might help your ability to recover, but also developing your capacities anaerobically, if you like, so above that critical power or threshold, that's going to increase the size of that battery, as you put it earlier.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Mm. Right? If you have a very minimal anaerobic capacity, then no matter how quickly you can recover from it, you're never going to be able to, over the course of, let's say, 90 minutes, expend a lot of anaerobic energy, because the amount of energy expended anaerobically is small. So they both would be important. In terms of practical recommendations, what do you want athletes and coaches to take away as the key messages from this episode and generally from your work in durability that can be applied in training and or racing?
So I guess the main point is to draw athletes and coaches' attention to this characteristic as something worth thinking about. So as I mentioned in my work as an applied exercise physiologist, we tend to profile people in a well-rested state and make inferences about how they've adapted to training from those numbers. But really, we might not be capturing that in those well-rested assessments. It's going to be later on in a long-duration bout of exercise where we might see those meaningful changes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what's next for you and for the scientific community as a whole within the concept of durability? Do you have anything cooking right now, any new projects or research going on?
Yeah, so we're developing some projects at the moment to look at the physiological determinants of durability and why some athletes seem to be more resilient than others over prolonged duration exercise, and also trying to develop better means of measuring and quantifying that during prolonged bouts of exercise.
Is there anything you can mention specifically about that, or is it still too early?
It's probably a little bit early to give any early findings from that research.
All right. I want to ask you one more question, which is something we talked about pre-recording, which is some other research you've done with regard to heat adaptation or training in the heat. You mentioned an interesting study that you've done comparing heart rate matched training in the heat compared to temperate conditions and adaptation to that training. Can you just discuss what you did there and what your findings were?
Yeah, sure. So we had two groups of cyclists train in either 18 degrees, which is quite a cool environment, or 33 degrees, so quite hot. And they did 3 weeks of training in those conditions, and their training was prescribed relative to their heart rate thresholds. So effectively, heart rate matched between the two groups. And then we took a range of performance and metabolic measures before and after the training program. So despite the athletes who trained in the heat putting out less power during their training sessions because it was heart rate matched and the hot environment would have increased their heart rate for given power outputs, the athletes who trained in the heat had better performance improvements, so greater magnitude of change in their endurance performance. And that was assessed with a 30-minute time trial that came after a two-hour constant load bout of cycling. And there was evidence of greater adaptation within the muscle in those athletes who trained in the heat. So there may be some interaction with training under heat stress and metabolic adaptations to endurance training.
Yeah, that's a really really interesting finding, and I'll make sure to link to that paper as well in the show notes, so listeners can go and have a look. And now it looks like we have Stephen with us as well. So welcome, Stephen. We've kind of covered most of the topics that we had on durability, but I do want to ask you for your take on sort of practical recommendations for athletes and coaches. From your perspective, what do you think are the important things to consider? What do you think people need to absolutely know about durability? And then secondly, how do you recommend people go about actually training it and developing it?
I think the number one challenge for people is to get out of their mind that they're fresh. You know, let's call it their fresh FTP or their fresh 5 minute, 6 minute power, whatever the variables they are. They often train to these metrics and feel compelled to always try to improve 20 minute power. And that becomes the their key focus. And in reality, number one, that stabilizes fairly quickly in the career of an endurance athlete, a few years. And number two, it's not a number that is relevant 4 hours into a race, or it's not totally irrelevant, but it's not the power they have available when they're climbing the last climb of the 15th stage of the tour, you know. And so that is why we need to be looking at durability, high intensity, repeatability, and athletes need to be conscious of the deterioration that they're trying to manage, that they're trying to both manage through training and manage in races. Now, the next issue is, well, okay, it's fine. Yeah, so I guess the next issue is then, okay, Stephen, how do I train for this? What's, you know, do I, perhaps one of the key questions that's being asked right now is, do I train fresh? In other words, do I use the typical idea, which is be ready, come into a high intensity workout rested and ready, or do I actually try to create the conditions and simulate the partial fatigue that is associated with having to mobilize a high power output for 30 minutes on a long climb or something to that effect, several hours into an effort? And it appears that there are adaptations that we need to create these conditions, or we need to stress the organism either both at the cellular level and the systemic level in order to continue to extend that durability. whether the typical culprits that we focus on are glycogen availability and plasma volume loss through dehydration. But the reality is it's looking like it's more than that. There are other aspects to the physiology, such as reactive oxygen species, heat shock protein. There's a number of issues related to how cells manage and tolerate stress, you know, muscle cells. And I think we're just digging into the weeds there. So that's going to be exciting when scholars like Ed, myself, and others try to develop studies that both mechanistically explore this, but also practically, you know, generate some guidelines and some tools for athletes to help them understand and measure the durability, measure the high intensity repeatability. Because if you can't really measure it, then it is more difficult to see how it's developing. And then two, develop, you know, some appropriate training methodology for it.
So in terms of measuring it, I know that you have been involved in working with a training monitoring platform. If that's what we call it, is that something that you measure on that platform? Is it Endura that it's called?
Yeah, well, Endura, we've developed Endura more as a research tool, more as trying to go into the weeds, look at some of these issues. How do we connect the internal workload to the external workload? Because that's one of the key issues is, you know, just conceptually, you're trying to look at the relationship between the external workload, the actual, you know, that neutral load that you're imposing on the body, whether it's, you know, 80% of maximum lactate steady state, however you want to express it as a load that's calibrated. That's the load. And then you look at how does the body respond over time, not just the first 10 minutes, but over time. And so we've just developed a tool, you know, with ways of getting at that relationship and looking at how it's measured. And we've generated some data, some of that data early days data was published in the study with Ed as lead author. And, you know, we're doing some more work in that direction towards how do you quantify that. Now, one of the ways you can quantify it that we think is useful is just looking at heart rate, looking at that cardiovascular decoupling or cardiac drift. But there are issues there that you have to be controlled for. And when we've, for example, controlled for dehydration so that there's no differences in dehydration, we still see big differences in decoupling, meaning the relative amount of cardiac drift for a given athlete over a time at a given workload, at the same relative workload. So we're just trying to get into the weeds there. However, I don't think heart rate's good enough. It's not sufficient. It's important, it's useful, but it's not a sufficient tool, particularly as you move into more of the high intensity repeatability challenge, because once heart rate gets, you know, up to 85, 90% automatically as a function of the actual demands of the workload, then there's a ceiling effect. There is really nowhere for heart rate to go. So therefore, you don't see a lot of drift just because it can't drift up above 100%. So it becomes it's not a useful tool then to as a metric of this decoupling. So what is ventilation, is, you know, are there, could we see things with muscle oxygenation? Could we see things with EMG? You know, these are questions that are being asked, and you know, there's many technologies that are being presented as potential tools in this environment. And you know, they all come with some type of mechanistic potential. But the proof is in the eating, and so far, you know, we're still not in a situation where we can say, yes, this new tool, it is informing that process in a way that is fundamentally better. I'm not ready. I haven't found that tool yet. I'm hoping, you know, when we're exploring that, but I'm a bit optimistic just on the issue of ventilation, on breathing, because breathing is a vital sign. It is like heart rate is one of the most directly accessible variables that is telling something about what is happening there and then in the musculature. In fact, ventilation is interesting because it is more keenly and directly connected to the second-to-second changes in the muscular milieu than heart rate, because heart rate is almost a central point of view, smoothed data type of window, whereas ventilation will move up and down and has a broader scope of change. So anyway, that's one issue we're pursuing.
Mm. I'm going to ask one more question of both of you, and that is, if we look at this from a triathlon perspective, half and full distance triathlon, how important is durability on the spectrum of from super fundamental to a super marginal gain on, if you want to, I guess, look at it from that side? And is it different for pros versus amateurs? So Ed, do you want to go first? How important is it? Is it super important, not at all important, somewhat important, or yeah, and place it on that spectrum, if you will, and then explain why you did so.
So we're talking about endurance sport. So I would argue that it's super important. Absolutely. That's not to say you can get away without having your well-rested physiology being impressive. But I think to excel in a sport like long-distance triathlon, absolutely, you need both. You need to be of a sufficient level when well-rested, but also in that seventh, eighth hour of the Ironman, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And for amateur athletes, would you think that the relative importance is equally important as for professionals, or is there a difference there?
I would argue that they're just as important for pros as amateurs. Now, amateur athletes probably have more scope to improve their well-rested physiological profile, if you like, compared to professionals who are going to be plateauing at some point in those measures. So there may be more work to do on that front in an amateur cohort, but certainly the durability aspect is going to be more than marginal for a long distance triathlete, even at the amateur level.
Yeah. And Stephen, what's your take on it?
Yeah, well, I agree with what Ed said, and I would just probably add that there is a filtering process. The high performance triathletes, elite level, they've been filtered up based on some physiology that probably gives them genetic advantages in durability, for principally a very large slow twitch fiber type ratio. And it looks that probably in and of itself improves durability. Athletes that have a more mixed composition will probably have a greater fatigability over time. So what that kind of in my head means maybe is that actually the age groupers, the amateurs that are more, let's just say, more typical in terms of their fiber composition and so forth, they may have more scope for improvement in that relative durability relative to their fresh physiology. And so yeah, for me, it's super important, but it's not just super important in the triathlon. It's super important in essentially any event beyond a couple of hours. Durability and high intensity repeatability becomes an issue. And I guess the only thing I might add to all this is what's interesting. Although I work a lot with cycling and cross country skiing and sports where there is a lot of stochasticity, you know, this variation in intensity, it seems like that's also becoming more relevant in the triathlon just because of the nature of the courses that are being built. Tighter loops, more public friendly, viewer friendly, which means there's more 90 degree turns, there's more short spiky hills, So you have these courses that are potentially more, they generate a higher demand on a non-even tempo. They demand that the athlete actually does charge up those hills and accelerate out of those corners, which puts a bigger demand on that high intensity repeatability, even in an event that I think cognitively we typically associate with a very steady pace.
Yeah, I know for a fact from talking directly with Daril Tveiten, the coach of the Norwegian Olympic triathlon team, that they have been directly assessing durability in the way that we talked about with Ed earlier in the interview, with just doing a certain amount of work, which they do at a fairly high intensity, kind of almost simulating the race and expending a certain amount of kilojoules, and then testing how their performance metrics, their physiology changes after that to simulate the second half or the last quarter of the Olympic distance triathlon. So that's something that they're definitely looking at, which is no surprise knowing how closely they follow the current trends in science, I guess. So it is definitely coming there. I don't know. We didn't talk specifically about high intensity repeatability, but I would absolutely not be surprised if they're also looking at that directly, like you said. Because what you're saying about the changes in courses and race dynamics in short course triathlon, in sprint and Olympic, is absolutely true. And also there is this trend with the Olympic pathway triathletes doing more and more sprint distance races and mixed relay with very short events, super league triathlon, super sprints, and those sorts of things. So events are kind of becoming more skewed towards the shorter side, where that high intensity repeatability, I guess, is really important, even if the duration of the events is not long. But in the Olympic distance, that certainly is the case. It's almost 2 hours, and you still have all those corners, all those sprints, uphills and out of corners and so on. So definitely agree with what you're saying. Now, let's wrap this up. And
well, the driver of all of that is television, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's going to be exciting. Just a few weeks from when we're talking, we will have the first ever mixed relay in the Olympics. So that will be really exciting. Well, Stephen, you've been on before and you've answered rapid fire questions. So I'm going to ask these from Ed. And this is just questions to answer with one sentence. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
I really like anything Alex Hutchinson writes. I really enjoyed Endure. I've been enjoying Mark Burnley's exercise physiology videos on YouTube recently.
Yeah, those are both great resources. What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Well, I might be a little early in my career to talk about advice on being successful, but to-do lists, daily to-do lists, checklists. It's a book called The Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande that I took a lot from.
And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
My father. Very incredibly willing to think through a problem. And that's something that I try to emulate from time to time.
Perfect. And finally, where can we follow you both? Twitter, other social media, ResearchGate profiles that you keep up to date. Let the listeners know if they want to keep following your projects and your research.
I'm on Twitter, so that's Maunder_Ed, and then ResearchGate too.
And Stephen?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as well, just Stephen Seiler and ResearchGate. And then sporadically, I throw out some videos on YouTube. I have a YouTube channel.
All right, great. I'll link to all of that in the show notes. Thank you both for coming on, for taking the time. It was really interesting to talk about this topic and really looking forward to reading any future work that you're going to do in this realm. It's definitely exciting to see where this develops.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. I want to just add one thing to it after the fact, which is something that I have discussed quite a bit before in, for example, TTS first day episodes when discussing bike training and run training in particular. Check out those particular episodes if you want to go into more detail. But that is the concept of what I called in those episodes and what I tend to call fatigue resistance workouts, which essentially is doing some hard work after having already expended a fairly large amount of energy. So it could look like doing 3 hours of riding at zone two in a five zone system, so just endurance riding. And then after that, doing, let's say, 30 minutes of riding at around 7.3 race intensity. That's a simple but very effective example of a fatigue resistance workout that I use a lot and prescribe a lot. So when you in the past have heard me talk about fatigue resistance workouts, that really aligns very nicely with this concept of durability. And that's sort of one of the main points that those workouts do develop. So that's just to draw some lines and connect some dots for you. As always, you can find the show notes from the episode on scientifictriathlon.com with links to the papers that we mentioned, including the one that is about durability, which is a really good one. I highly recommend you checking it out, but also Twitter profiles, ResearchGate profiles, and so on, everything that we mentioned there. If you're interested in coaching services or training plans and want to take your triathlon performance to the next level, go and check out our services on scientifictriathlon.com or get in touch with me directly on email if you want to get more information. We would love to help you out and help you achieve your goals. Big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and stamina, and increase your swim stimulus frequency even when you can't go to the pool or the open water. Get more than 40% off your order until mid-August when you combine the summer sale with a special discount code that you can get on senatetrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving craft.